Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9. I'm here in the office of Mads Torgerson. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, especially now that you're here.
I was expecting to find like a bearskin rug or like maybe some antlers from, you're not a hunter?
I'm not that much of a hunter. I do have an IKEA chair though.
Oh, that's right. I mean, that's...
I'm sorry it didn't fit in the frame.
Cool. Well, I thought we'd talk a little bit about C#.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do.
Great idea, man.
I know.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I wanted to ask you about was C# 6 is out.
Yep.
What are the features that are like, you should start using these?
Well, okay, so all of them really. but we can talk about a few that are maybe, probably the ones that people have latched onto the most.
Let's do
Even
it.
You know, there's some of the really simple features, they tend to work for people. So, the C# 6 in general, it's a grab bag of little features that's kind of like, all the little things we never got around to.
It felt like a polished sort of release.
Yeah, it was like clean up your code was kind of the theme. Here are little things so your code will shrink and become more readable and more elegant. But I'll show you a few that are ones that I think people will find really helpful. So one that's kind of maybe the most nifty is the what we call the null conditional operator, which you can also call the question dot operator, or some people call it Elvis because it looks like this.
That's right.
And so there's kind of some swoop of hair there.
You just got to put like a little happy face, you know, because he always had like a...
Yeah.
There you go.
We should...
You should add that. Is there something in the ASCII?
A two-line.
Okay.
Okay. Stop.
okay.
Which is essentially an operator to say something like, so if you're accessing the, you're calling the M method on there, on an E or whatever, you want to say only call it if E is not null.
Right.
Okay, so this is for null checking. And kind of inlining that into your code rather than having separate ifs or whatever, like having a lot of boilerplate for checking for null. So it'll only call M if E is not null. And if E is null, then the whole thing becomes null. Right? So it sort of propagates the null through an expression rather than throwing a fit.
And when you're writing libraries, for example, though, you might want to throw an exception here that this shouldn't be null.
Sure.
Is this a good case to use this, or should you use if then?
Yeah, so this will not throw an exception.
Yeah.
So if you want to throw an exception, you should throw an exception.
Yeah.
This is really for when you want to be null tolerant, right? Sometimes null is bad, and sometimes it's good, right? Sometimes it's part of your domain, like it's legitimately null sometimes. But I only want to do this if it's not. Mm-hmm. So a good example of that, for instance, is if you have an event handler, or you have an event that you want to, like a field-like event that you want to trigger. And when people add or remove events with plus equals, minus equals, the event actually becomes null if there is no event handler currently there, right? So even the language feature for events, you have some delegate, let's actually call it E for event. You have some event, and sometimes it's null and sometimes it's not. And so triggering the event is a bit cumbersome in pre C# 6 code, right? Because you first have to check if it's not null. So you say, if the event is not equal to null, you know, then go fire it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of boilerplate code.
Right, because now you're like, oh wait, but E is actually maybe accessible for multiple threads or something. So maybe right after I checked it for null, somebody else went and removed the last event handler, and by the time I get here it's null and I blow up anyway. So now you need to kind of say if you have to say temp equals E. And then if temp isn't equal to null, then fire temp to avoid blowing up and blah, right? So
yeah, it doesn't feel nice.
Right. So a great like special case for the, let's keep the horrible code out here for a bit, is to just say event question. It would be really great if you could say when conditionally invoke. Right. We can't actually do that in C# because that gets too ambiguous with the question colon operator and so on. So the parser can't. It's truly ambiguous. There's nothing we can do. VB allows this, by the way.
Oh.
But the second best is the event handler is a delegate, and all delegate methods, all delegates have an invoke method. So you can say question.invoke like that.
And this is better when it's thread safe too, because it does a check right away and invokes right away.
Yes. So that you can think of it as being atomic. It takes a copy. And both does the check and the invocation on there.
On different threads, you might be adding and taking events off, and so it might not dispatch properly.
Right.
Okay.
So this has the same effect as this up here, but it's much nicer. So question.invoke, your new pattern for event handling.
Cool. Is there any other?
Triggering events.
There's probably a lot of other places where you can use this, but this is probably one of the best.
Is just one. But you'd use it. You tend to use it all over the place. Yeah. You have code where you do if this is not null, then dot in, grab it into a local, then say if that one's not null, So you kind of have these cascading triangles of checking for longer and longer chains not being null and grabbing them into local variables or dotting further and further in. And this can often be reduced to a single expression now. We just have question marks in strategic places.
And so you can Elvis operator all the way down.
All the way down, right? So you do something like that. You can put the question mark in front of a dot. You can also put it in front of indexing, so you can do it sort of all the way down. Right?
Oh, I see. So if there's nothing in the array, for example, you're not going to have to check if the length is greater than zero, kind of stuff.
Yes, if the array is null, or if something that has an indexer on it is null, then you'd use this operator.
Got it. Okay, cool.
So you get this long chain, and you just say if. You can say if that whole thing not equal to null when you're all the way down, or maybe what you do is you just say var result equals that whole question chain here dot x or whatever, and then you use the null coalescing operator that we already have in the language to say, or if any of that was null, then you just use set. Right, then that's a default value order. So this whole thing becomes whatever the result of this is, if nothing was null along the way, or this is the default value if it was, and that's what goes into the variable.
In essence, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, well, this is older, but you have 4 nested if statements that you can now put on one line.
Yeah.
Nice, much better.
So I think it's better.
Yeah, I mean.
It's one of those swearing code risks, right? You don't want to see too much punctuation in your code, then it's like it's swearing at you. So kind of have to be a little aware of that.
Okay.
But it certainly cleans up a lot of code.
All right, so that's one.
That's one. And I'm going to erase, but people can rewind if they want to look
sure,
at more.
Sure.
Hit the pause button now.
Yeah.
I think some little ones that are, I should get you to do that.
Yeah, I know. I'll be the eraser next time.
You can be the eraser.
Got it.
Maybe the red is easier to erase than the green. Some of the little ones that are really nifty is I like string interpolation a lot.
Okay.
So you know how string format?
Yeah.
It's actually very good, and I tend to use it a lot. Well, I used to.
String.format,
because in the format string, you can really do many nifty things. You put your little placeholders in here. You can
put a colon.
Yeah, you can do the comma with alignment operators, and you can do the colon with whatever kind of formatting stuff you want there, and have multiple of those. And then you put your arguments back here. And that's sort of, so the only problem with it is, sort of visually, you kind of have to, when you read this code, you have to pair up the 0 with the first argument and the 1 that would appear here with the next argument, and it sort of gets messy and also a little hard to maintain. It's easy to like move some things around and not keep them in correspondence. So we're like, all these modern new languages, they have what they call string interpolation now, which is really just string formatting built into the language. We're like, hey, we should have that, but we should think of it as essentially pretty syntax on top of string format.
Right.
Okay, so we essentially built syntax for string format is the way to think of it. So you can now do this thing instead by saying dollar in front of a string literal, and now you still have these curly holes inside of the string, but what you put there instead of a placeholder numeral is the actual expression that you want to evaluate and toString and glue into that place in the string.
And I think it's important to mention that it's an expression, not just a variable.
Right, it's any old expression. And it's particularly important to point out because most of the string interpolation out there is very limited in what you can put in there.
Yeah.
You can put pretty much any old expression you want in there. Da 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 da. Question dot something.
Now we're going back. Nice.
And then at the end of it, you can still put your commas and your colons, your formatting specifiers if you want to. So it's kind of natural. Syntaxification of string format, if you will.
Well, the benefit also is if you're doing refactoring, for example, it will catch these variables and these expressions in here too.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is totally language syntax. This zone here is outside of the string, if you will. It's really code. It's not some kind of placeholder things. You can see if you do it in the IDE and not on the whiteboard, you would see that these are colorized. This expression is colorized like everything else. So it's really an expression sitting in a hole in the string.
Is there ever a reason, if you're now in C# 6, to use this instead of this?
Yes, there can be. If you want to do versions of string note format, might allow you to format things differently.
Okay.
Right. You can so by default, an interpolated string will always use the standard string note format, which means, for instance, format according to a current culture.
Got it.
Okay. There are actually, we made it a little niftier. So if you take one of these interpolated string literals and you turn it into, instead of turning it, sort of by nature it's a string, but you can sort of target type it to a nasty interface called let's see if I can spell it. iFormattable. It's a new interface we added. If you cast it to that interface instead, iFormattable is an existing interface there. And then we have a new class that implements that. That's called Formattable String. And if you cast to either one of those directly from one of those, it doesn't format it. It captures a format string and all the arguments separately into a little object that you can then get back. And then you can take those pieces and format it whichever way you like.
That's interesting because I just realized that, for example, if you're showing a date in Europe, it's going to be much different than showing a date here in the US.
That's right.
And if you're running like this global thing and your server's in the US, you got to pass in the current UI culture info.
Right. So sometimes you want to give it a different culture info or you want to format it invariantly so that it's the same across.
And you can do that by casting it to this and then doing the stuff
right
there.
And actually, that's a helper method. The formattable string class I mentioned, let's just abbreviate it here. Mm-hmm. It has an invariant static method on it. And if you pass, which takes formattable string. Mm-hmm. And so if you pass it an interpolated string, it will format it invariantly instead of the default current culture.
Okay, well that's cool. So I knew about this. I did not know about all of this extra goodness.
And most people don't need to know about that.
Right.
Except if you're using a library that takes a formattable string. Well, what you need to know is you can still pass it an interpolated string, and then it will do something special with it.
I see.
You could also imagine like injection attacks or something like that. If you want to just check those arguments before you format, you could write code to do that.
So you could pass. So I could have a method that takes an iFormattable F and just pass this in and it will work.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool. All right. Cool. So what's the next thing?
The next thing, and this is a tiny thing.
Oh, not yet.
Because we can show it in the context of this if we want to.
Oh, cool.
The next thing would be the name of operator. So one thing that's common is if this is all inside of a function, let's say method void m that takes an int x, or that's fine, int x. And we want to use the name of this parameter somewhere, or the name of the method itself. Well, the name of operator is really a way of, instead of just, let's say I wanted to put x inside of this string here, and I wanted to talk about m inside of here by name. Uh-huh. So have those, instead of hard coding those into the string, we can use the name of operator. So the name of operator, name of x here, it just produces a string x, but it checks that x is actually something that's defined by the compiler.
I see.
So it's kind of like the safe way of, the refactoring safe way of referencing something in the program itself.
So you might have a variable that you name that's very important when you're throwing an exception, for example. You want to say, this variable does not have anything, and if you refactor, the string doesn't refactor.
Right. Or if you have something that depends on reflection, like your iNotify property change thing or whatever, you want to make sure that you keep referencing when you need to pass strings for to talk about program elements, you want to make sure you keep talking about the right ones.
Right.
And so this keeps it refactoring safe. If you do a name refactoring, rename refactoring in the IDE, it will correctly rename inside of a name of. And so inside here, instead of just writing X in there in the string, I would say open curly for a hole, and then I would evaluate the expression name of X, which would produce a string X, and glue it into place in the right place in the interpolated string. And I do the same with M further down.
Sure.
Right,
so
so that's name of. It's actually, you know, when you think about it, it's a string literal that is longer and more prone to produce errors.
Yeah.
So what's good about it is exactly that it keeps you on the right path with only referencing things that are defined in the program.
Okay, well, is there anything else in C# 6 before we move on to C# 7?
Now, we could probably stop here. There are a few more abbreviation things that you should look at. There's expression-bodied methods where instead of having the curlies,
a lambda?
What we used to call a lambda arrow, and I think we should get used to now calling it a function arrow.
Okay.
You just put that on a regular method or property or index or whatever, and then put a single expression here in a semicolon. And that's sort of just shorthand for the method body that would return that expression.
And this works on all methods, like static methods as well?
Yeah, it works all over the pretty much wherever it makes sense. It doesn't work for constructors and a few other places where it doesn't really make sense because they're always void returning finalizers, but mostly it works.
So all method types, void, returning types, but just not special kinds of functions like constructors?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. Indexers, whatever.
All right, so we are, C# 6 is out. C# 7, are we starting to think about that? What's going on there?
Yeah.
Let me get in here and delete this.
Yeah, watch this guy doing actual work.
Oh my gosh, it's fantastic. Look how good, I'm doing this better than you. I mean, I have a lot more practice.
I think it's the red that's better.
Nice. So we've
been thinking about C#, we call it codename C# 7.
Okay.
Okay, so we're thinking about what's next in the language. And we sort of opened up, if you will, a bunch of work streams or investigations into separate features or themes that we think are likely to be among the most important things we can do for the language.
I see.
And whether all of those will make it ever into the language or which version they'll make it into, that's kind of an open question. But we just kind of work on them in parallel and try to give more focus to the ones that we think have more A, value, and B, possibility of success, if you will.
But this feels a little bit different than years past, because it's not like there's like a back room over there where you all get in there and sit down and are like, right. She says we need to do this, he says we need to do that. It's a little bit more open this time, right?
It is a lot more open because we actually embarked on this towards the end of the C# 6 design cycle when we were still on CodePlex.
Yeah.
We do publish the design notes right after the meeting, meaning whenever I get around to writing them up nicely and putting them out. We used to do that on CodePlex. We now do that on GitHub, where we are at now.
So I'll make a link.
So all our discussions internally on, we still have a language design team. We're still the ones who define C#, unless somebody out there wants to fork it and try to compete with us. Since it's all open source. So we still feel like it's important that control over the language is sort of centralized. We're a little dictatorial like that, because we want the language to not like run amok.
Right.
We want it to maintain its kind of culture and feel, even as it evolves to meet new demands. Mm-hmm. But that said, we have a very active GitHub site where lots and lots of proposals come in that we look at and evaluate, and we have our own stuff, our own ideas that we put out there for discussion, sometimes in the shape of the design notes, sometimes in the shape of proposals that people on the team as well as people off the team will put out and for public discussion. We get a lot of really valuable input on them from that.
So it feels like C# 6 was a polish for release. What kind of themes do you see for C# 7? What are you thinking about?
So there are a few ones that I think are important. I think there are two overall driving trends, I think, in a lot of application development. Not everything, but a lot of development that's going on out there, let's say. that really warrants the language kind of helping you out. I think the one that most people will probably recognize is that in practice, a lot of development is now distributed.
Yeah.
Distributed. Not in the sort of traditional sense necessarily of distributed computing, because you can't fit a particular computation on one machine or whatever, there's some of that as well. But just the fact that you're writing apps and there are services that those apps talk to, that either you, the same person develops in tandem or you're using public services, whatever, it's all a distributed system. And the sort of first step that we took in the language towards that world is async, mm-hmm. which we did in C Sharp 5 to kind of embrace the latency aspect, if you will, to kind of steer away from the callback hell that mm-hmm. was kind of the that was holding back development in that whole space. And async has become super popular in other languages as well. It's making its way into JavaScript and yeah. to C++. And so the async await thing was really something we pioneered there. But that's sort of just the ground rules of the infrastructure itself. Like, you can get back to writing good idiomatic C# imperative code with async await. Now the next thing, I think, is about what those latencies were, because things are talking over the wire. Mm-hmm. What are they saying over the wire? And what is the information flowing? How do you describe that, and how do you write functionality over it?
I see.
So that's pretty abstract. So I think that there's sort of a schism between our traditional object-oriented worldview, where you have very stateful objects that you manipulate and then they change a little, and you sort of have, in that sense, you kind of have your own little global state,
uh-huh.
and you are incrementally manipulating it. Well, that's very different from information that flows over the wire. It's not stateful. It's like an immutable piece of information, typically structured information, like it's a tree of something, an object graph or whatever, but it's not stateful. It's immutable.
Mm-hmm.
And it also doesn't come with its own set of operations like object-oriented programming does. So typically in object-oriented programming, you will have some kind of a little inheritance hierarchy or whatever, and you can express different, so this is a different shape than that one. Like, we can talk about even mm-hmm. physical shapes, like the figure and circle and rectangle or whatever, that mm-hmm. the classic examples. And then you can manipulate them with virtual methods. So this one up here has a move and a draw, and they're virtual, so they'll be overwritten here. And that means that the activity is, the thing that the method does depends on the shape of the object.
Yeah.
And the way you describe that dependency is by having a virtual method that you override. But if you have information that flows between different usage domains, if you will, you can't have it travel with its own inherent functionality. You want the functionality to be described independently of the objects.
Right? I see.
So that's more like functional programming,
yeah.
where you have over here, I'm interested in drawing. This is the drawer. So over here, I am interested in drawing aspects of a given sort of set of shapes. In another place, I may be interested in computing things about them or whatever. The functionality and the data shapes are independent.
So in essence, my sense is that you want to be able to separate, here are things and here are what we do with things.
Yes. Yes, because what you do may be tied to which application is currently accessing the data, or which service is currently manipulating or whatever. It's not strongly tied to the shapes themselves.
And that's interesting, because
to the
data
itself.
There's always a set of actions that you're always going to do, like save or delete or I don't know. I mean, there's tons of actions that you could sort of generalize over multiple different data shapes.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes. So the trick is, and this is where functional programming languages have gotten things more right.
Yeah.
The trick is, once you're writing not a move virtual method here, but a move function over here, say, or it can even be mutating it. But once you write that independently of the shape, how do you express the differences in what it should do depending on which shape it's looking at? If it's not a virtual function that overrides for each each class here, how do you say, oh, if it's a circle, do this, if it's a rectangle, do that?
It's interesting because it feels like it's the reverse of object-oriented.
Yes.
Because at the top is the function, and then as methods are not methods, they're the data shapes that it can take.
Right. It is, and this is at the heart of functional programming, is really the reverse. And you can certainly do that in C# today. You can say, so inside of this move, let's say you have a move that takes a shape S. You can certainly do things like, if maybe you say var r equals s as rectangle, and then you say if r wasn't null, then it was a rectangle. Then I can do rectangle things to r in here. You know, so I'll do things the rectangle way. Uh-huh. And then else, or you return out of here, and then you do the same thing for circle.
I mean, it just feels wrong as we're writing it.
Yes.
And not only that, but what if they make a triangle out of a shape? Now all of a sudden, you're not moving triangles, you're only moving rectangles and circles.
But now you're talking about a inherent weakness of the functional paradigm.
Right.
So I can't do anything about that. So that this being kind of messy and hard, that and feeling like you're going against the grain of the language, I want to change that. So let's get back in a minute to how we can make the language better for this kind of approach. However, the functional idea is that the thing that is durable, hard to change, is the set of shapes that you're operating.
Okay.
So I have functions all over the world that depend on there being these five shapes.
Okay.
And if you introduce a sixth shape, they're all in trouble. Or they have some default fallback that isn't very good.
Okay.
That's actually, you're onto something when you say it's exactly the opposite of object-oriented programming. Object-oriented programming, I can add new shapes whenever I want and just override my virtual methods. What's the thing that's constant in this world, the thing that's hard to change? When I have like classes all over the world that inherit from figure.
They're all figures.
Well, that, but also the set of virtual methods that you have.
Oh, it doesn't change.
That can't change.
That's right.
So in the object-oriented world, you have a closed set of functions over an open set of shapes.
Interesting.
And in the functional world, you have an open set of functions over a closed set of shapes. Isn't that beautiful?
It's kind of an interesting symmetry.
It's a dual. It's really dualistic in almost a mathematical sense. Eric Meyer would probably tell you so as well. So this is great when you are in your own little world. If you need to move into a place where the activity needs to be separated from the description of the shapes, then you gotta make this type of approach easier. So we kind of want to get to where some other languages are that both paradigms are more well supported. Like F# certainly supports better paradigms with a weight to the functional side, but pretty good object-oriented support. And so does Scala, for instance, as a multi-paradigm language. So we want to get further into the functional camp because then we believe we serve the information payloads over the wire scenario much better. Okay, so instead of writing ugly code like this, we want to get into something like pattern matching.
Of course.
Pattern matching is what functional languages use to quickly say, oh, I'm in this case and I'm dealing with this kind of thing. So we want to do something like, and this is totally mock syntax.
Spitballing right now.
You could say something like match S. And then you could say rectangle R, and then something you do when it's an R. And then you have more cases down here, and maybe you have a default at the end that says what to do if you hadn't talked about the one that came in. And so you just want syntax that much more smoothly wraps around that, the set of shapes that we're interested in and kind of.
See, and I was thinking even like one step behind, which doesn't make sense, S is rectangle, but then here you're actually checking if it's a rectangle and putting it into a variable at the same time, which
yes.
is much nicer.
Right. And then typically pattern matching features go a step further, and we're thinking about that too, where if you know it's a rectangle, then of course you can grab it as a rectangle, and you can say r dot lower left in here, or r dot upper right, or whatever your things you want that rectangles have, because now you know it's a rectangle. You could also go a step further and do recursive pattern matching, where you say, and again, syntax, whatever the syntax might be, you could say something like rectangle point upper left, point lower right, or maybe you can just say var because it's a given
right.
what they are, but I'm just saying point here. And so instead of giving a name to the rectangle, you immediately decompose it into its part. Now that you know it's a rectangle, you can immediately decompose it into its parts and use those parts directly.
That's very Python-esque, you know, where you can actually set var one, variable one, variable two, comma variable two equals this whole thing.
Yeah.
But now we're doing it in pattern. We could do it in pattern matching.
We could do it in pattern matching. And that is, I mean, this is not new innovation. This is something that functional languages have been doing all the time. So we just need to decide, you know, some small matters of syntax.
Yeah.
Like, how far down this rabbit hole do we want to go? Do we want to have recursive pattern matching or just sort of type switching top level that we saw first? So where exactly do we want to go with this? There's also sort of at the top level here, which kinds of features do we want that apply patterns? I put it with a new syntax here, match. You could actually, and we have been looking at, you could generalize the switch, good old switch statement, to work with patterns. So you say case, and then instead of it having to be a constant value, you could have a whole pattern there saying.
Sort of reusing whatever the infrastructure we have.
So we use the infrastructure we already have. So we probably want to go down that path, make switch more general like that. But on the other hand, switch is kind of clunky in a syntax, so we might also want to introduce a new, more nifty syntax for it.
So then you would consider doing both or one or the other?
Yeah, everything's depends, on the table there. There's also a simpler case where you're really just interested in one case. So we're thinking about generalizing the is expression. So today you can say if let's use the shape here. If S is rectangle, but then that's not very useful because now I know it's a rectangle.
Now you need to cast it.
Now I need to cast it. Why? But you just told me. So just instead of just allowing a type there, allow a pattern.
Oh, interesting.
So you could like introduce new variables on the fly here that will be in scope in the if statement saying, you know, if S is a rectangle, call that R and use that in the if branch here, and, you know.
That's interesting, because now once you have this notion of these patterns,
right.
you can start to put them in other places.
Yes.
Like, for example, if you want to get point NL and left right, you can actually set that as the left-hand side of an assignment operator.
That's, yes, so that's one option you can think about, like pure unconditional deconstruction. So where you're just saying something like var x comma y or whatever equals something that returns
two things, a tuple.
Two things, which gets us into tuples. Maybe we want to have, so that's another feature we're looking at. Do we actually want tuple syntax? And we think we do, right? So you could have something, a method that returns a tuple, and you could just deconstruct it on the fly. But then when you do that, you don't want to have that be something that only sometimes works. You want to use a deconstruction only when you know that the thing that comes back is something that can be deconstructed.
And that's something that needs to be statically checked at compile time.
Yeah, the compiler would know. Okay, it is actually a tuple of int comma int, so I'm just giving these names. I'm not like checking it, because what would I do if it failed? Like, would I throw or silently ignore the assignment or like, so.
Yeah, that would change the return from the method as well, right? Because would you return just a tuple, or would you return 5, 3? Do you see what I'm saying? Because
no.
say these are two integers.
Yeah.
And this method could return a tuple of int int.
Yeah.
That for sure would be able to be decomposed.
Mm-hmm.
But what if instead of returning a tuple, you return 1, 3?
Oh, from within that method?
Yes. Is that something? Would it know that works?
Yeah. So if we sort of slide, I think we're done with pattern matching.
Yes.
So if we sort of slide into talking about tuples as well.
Let me delete all this stuff.
Tuple syntax would essentially be allowing you to group values together temporarily, right? So the so let's look at the method m. It would return, say, let's just call them x and y. So it would return int x comma int y. So that's how we imagine a tuple type looking like. We actually imagine some in some languages tuples are anonymous, like the different members of them don't. You can't give those names. They would just have standard names or no names at all. We think that it's important to have names. If you get three integers back, like how are you supposed to remember which is which?
Yeah.
We think the names are important. So you could then, inside of the method here, you would then just return, you could say, let's return 1, 3. That would then construct a tuple. It would know, because it's returning this type, it would know that this one's called x and this one's called y. So I probably don't have to say it down here again. Uh-huh. I don't have to repeat myself. But I probably could say it. I could say something like x colon 1, y colon 3.
And that's just for readability when you're, you know, if you have a lot of them, that you probably shouldn't return a lot of stuff. But if you do, it's for readability.
Yeah. So the nice thing about tuples, most of the time, you wouldn't even think of them as types, right? Mm-hmm. You think just, okay, this method returns three things. It takes three things, it returns three things. You'd think of them pretty much as if they were sort of symmetric to argument lists, right? They're just return lists.
And so that's interesting, because then that would remove the need for an out parameter in your method.
Yes. So it's a better way to get, it's a better way than out parameters typically to get things out of your method, to get multiple things out of your method. But then it's the fact that it is a type then comes in handy once in a while. Say if I wanted to write an async method that has to return a task of something. Well, so let's say this is masync, and it's an async method. Well, then I can return task of the tuple type. Okay, because it is actually type syntax, I can do a task of that whole thing, of that pair of things, and return that out of my async method. So, because it's an async method, returning the tuple in here, well then, now it'll be wrapped in a task, and somebody else will be awaiting it, and whoever is awaiting it, they just await a task of something, whatever came back from the m call here. But once awaited, a tuple comes out.
Yeah.
And I can do my deconstruction if we have that syntax, right? Your
x,
whatever var
x,
x comma y, or whatever syntax we want for that, right? So, as a type, even though you don't want to think of it too much as a type, it kind of makes things possible that even async methods can't have out parameters. So having multiple results out of an async method is a bit of a pain today. It's worse even than synchronous methods. But they could have tasks of tuples.
And that's interesting, right? Because it's like you're making an object without having to make an object or an anonymous type. It's just these are the things, and it's going to be deconstructed for you.
And so these tuple types, we think that they are probably struct types. That's sort of the most, you know, structs are good when you're just, when you have kind of short-lived constellations of data, because they're a little heavy when you copy them, but they're cheap. They don't, you don't need to allocate on the heap when you construct them. So for the typical uses of tuples, we think that they should be structs. That's more efficient.
Because structs are value types, right?
Value.
And also the notion that data is coming in unchanged would force us to think of these things as value types, right? You're getting values out because these things are not supposed to change, and if they are, you need to make a new thing.
Now, all that data may not be represented as tuples necessarily.
Right.
I think there would still be class hierarchies and stuff. I think tuples play a role in working with that data. Maybe things are stored as tuples in here as well.
Now, would these be restricted to simple types or classes, for example?
The stuff inside can be anything.
Yeah, I mean, see, I wrote a linear algebra library, and I had to, there's a lot of times where I'm returning matrix and vector.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't like doing out parameters, and I don't like, the other thing that's interesting in what you say is, I have a bunch of static methods that do all this stuff because it's just math.
Yeah.
Right, so what are some other things that we can do besides this tuple stuff, besides the pattern matching, that will sort of lend itself to functions now, the top member, and classes are now the sort of the lower member, as opposed to the old way?
Well, those are the main things. There's one that I there's one combination of all this, there's a couple of combinations of all this that I really like. One that we just talked about earlier this morning and last week a little bit is writing, say I want to write the body of a state machine. Okay, I have a state machine, you know, if I'm in state X and I get Y in over the wire, like, so maybe I'm reacting to some input.
Okay.
In sort of a classic state machine fashion. Well, what do you usually do in a state machine? Well, you build state objects that can do their own handling, mm-hmm. or you do some, but maybe you just have a grand big switch, a match, like I showed you before, a pattern match, uh-huh. where...
Oh, let me get in here. I'm like not even doing my job right now.
Oh, you're doing it.
There we go. Yeah.
Maybe you just match on two things. Maybe there's current state, and input. Because then you just match on a tuple.
Yeah.
And then you can say, well, I'm in the init state, and I just got a go input. That means I should do this. Or I'm in, so you get a super concise way of, by using pattern matching together with tuples, you get a super concise way of describing all those transitions that you would, whenever you sort of describe a state machine to someone, you always sit down and write out the transitions. And now you can just sort of do that literally in the code.
And that's kind of really nice because if you're drawing, like usually with state machines, you draw the circle and the arrow. You could literally look at every circle and then just write it.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because there might, if there is a case, here's the thing with pattern matching that maybe I have a question about. Obviously with pattern matching, it looks for all available pattern types. But if you're in a state machine, those might not all be available because they're in valid states. How do you handle that?
Right, so maybe there's a default arrow.
Error,
throw invalid, you know, something like that. And then you use name of to refer to
nice. See the things that are wrong.
That's awesome.
So that's one. I also want to mention one more thing, you can erase this part here. So one benefit I didn't mention of sort of the object-oriented approach to things is discoverability. So especially when I'm in an IDE, I walk up to my shape or my rectangle, say, let's just say shape. So I say s dot, and then I see what methods are available on it. So s dot move, and that's really nice. But if you move into a world where you have to say move of s, well, I had the s, but how did I know to call move on it? How did I know what operations were available on it? Well, maybe it was maybe you declared that function as an extension method.
Okay.
Right? So it kind of blends well with extension methods as well. I say all the functions that I want to apply to shapes, I define those as extension methods on shape. And now I get back to having the s dot, and I can see what's in this app, what can I do with shapes here?
I see.
As opposed to some other app or some service having other extension methods on shape for what they will be doing on them.
So with extension methods, you can already kind of do that already, right?
Yeah, so extension methods as they are today would work great for that. Mm-hmm. I'm just mentioning as a great combo of features that sort of counter one of the downsides of the functional approach. You kind of want to get to where you have good completion on based on the object you have in your hand. What I have a thing, what can I do with it?
Yeah.
That's sort of the core dot experience of object-oriented programming. And extension methods can get you back there. We may want to, we have it on our list, a short list to consider. We may or may not make progress on it to consider other kinds of extension members, right?
I
so if it was a property, I would want to be able to say s.p and get that property as an extension property. There's no notion of extension property right now.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I may want to have static extension methods, like static factories that are only available in this context or whatever.
Well, that's interesting. So I love the way that we're thinking of functions at the top, you know, and see what can come from there. Are there any other themes that you're thinking about for C# 7?
Yeah, so that's definitely a big one, and it has lots of moving parts. Mm-hmm. Another trend that I think is important is that the set of targetable devices is actually, well, the set is growing larger, but the devices themselves are growing smaller and smaller. It used to be, like, I like to say, back around when we introduced dynamic, which is the most resource-consuming feature we ever added to the language, we kind of were in this PC-only mentality. Well, they're always going to grow bigger and get more and more cores and whatever. So if a feature is a little like, if something is
extravagant,
yeah, that's fine, because two years from now, Moore's Law will have taken care of it. And what we're seeing now is that devices are shrinking and shrinking. We're getting smaller and smaller devices that are interesting. And whenever we always want to try to get smaller and smaller and get into those machines. And so we have to be cognizant of resources, of space and time. And so we're probably going to take a look at some of the most egregious, at least, places in C# and .NET where you are, for instance, forced to copy. So and doing more things with ref, you have ref parameters today. Mm-hmm. We could have ref returns as well, ref locals.
I see.
So that you can pass essentially safe pointers around structs as long as they live on the stack, and avoid some copying there. We're thinking about whether we can do something that lets you access slices of arrays or maybe even of unmanaged memory without copying it.
Interesting.
So you kind of have like an array type that's like an array, but it doesn't have its own storage. It's kind of a view onto some other storage.
So let's see if I understand correctly. When you pass things by ref, you're passing in, it's like a safe pointer that you're accessing actually that memory.
Yeah.
So instead of having to copy it and put it on the heap or wherever it is you put it and work with it and then send something out, instead you're saying, okay, this section of memory we're going to be using.
Yeah.
And you're saying that now we want to do that with returns. Okay.
So you can imagine having, so think about a game engine, for instance. They will typically have a vast amount of state laid out in a huge array of structs, of value types, sitting neatly next to each other. So they just allocate up front, boom, here's where all the data lives for, you know, some the significant part of the game, in some structured fashion, based on structs. So they don't have to deal with the garbage collector, because that kills real-time gameplay. But how do I write a method that gives me back one of these? You know, give me the data for Seth in this game. And he's sitting right there as a chunk inside of this array. Well, how can I get that back without copying it?
Yeah.
Okay, like say it's still like, maybe it's a kilobyte of data or something. I don't want to copy that in my, return the struct. I want to return a ref to it. So nice. Enabling that kind of situation. And now also enabling locals to then, ref locals that can point to a struct without having it inside. That can be sort of a safe pointer.
It's being like more conscious about memory, because we don't have as much in the little devices.
About memory, but so definitely copying has two kinds of costs. Well, you're using memory for the same data multiple times. You're also spending a lot of time doing the copying, right? Wasteful time copying data to somewhere else just so you can have it twice. Like, so it's both space, but it's certainly also time.
Got
efficiency
it.
Of just passing around.
So I like the theme of going more functional because of the way the data is now coming over the wire, and then being more careful about resources on the device. Is there any last thing you want to talk about, C#?
Then there are a few that are a little less tied to themes, but there's one in particular that people have been asking for years and years and years. And we sort of thought that we tried before. We thought the train has left the station a long time ago on this, but we're trying one more time, trying to apply some fresh thinking to it, which is kind of statically avoiding null reference exceptions. So you saw us in C# 6 building features that let you do the null check in a way that's syntactically cheaper. But that doesn't help you remember to do it.
Yeah.
Right. What if, and this is not just like, some languages do have that. Even mainstream languages like Swift now have strong models of nullability where the compiler will not let you div reference, or you have to explicitly ask for an exception to, to the rule to div reference something that might be null. Okay, you have to then you have to first check it for null, you unpack it into something that you then know is not null, and then you can do something to that. But the original thing which might have been null, you don't get to dot into it.
I see.
So null is protected from dotting and from invoking and from those things. Up to the point of it actually probably being a little harsh. Like I hear people who work in languages like that, that, yeah, it does help me avoid some errors, but it also like gets a little harsh on me. Like, yeah. I have to kind of contort myself sometimes. So we're like, we want to help people get safer, get more safe behavior around us. At the same time, we don't want to be harsh. So we're trying to find a middle ground here.
Are you going
to
go full option explicit at the top?
No.
I know.
But it is a little, like, how do you tell people that their existing code is dubious without it being a breaking change to tell them, right? So we have to find a good balance between not feeling like we're breaking you, or I tested this code, why are you bothering me? But then still being useful in pointing out places where you are.
Maybe warnings or something, I don't know.
Yeah, so it's probably warnings. And then at the core of something like that, you need to be able to express syntactically your intent. Is this variable, this field, is this supposed, or this property or whatever, is it supposed to be null or to sometimes be null? Is that part of its domain like we talked about before? Or is it supposed not to?
I see.
And then we can give you warnings if people don't use it according to its intent.
Okay.
So if it's intended not to be null, then we can say, you're about to put null in there. Don't, you know, you're not supposed to do that. Or if it's supposed to be sometimes null, then you can say, this one might sometimes be null. Just make sure you check before you dot.
So it might be something in the language that, as a library writer, you might annotate this object and
yes.
say, this can be null sometimes,
yes.
be careful,
yeah.
or this should never be null.
And think about it, when you look at a class today, in a class in a library that you get, and you have all these properties on it, say, how do you know which ones could be null or not? How do you know which ones are intended to sometimes be null? And which
you
ones
don't.
You only do if you read the documentation or the comments.
Or you look at the code.
And they're there.
Yeah.
Right, and sometimes you can't even look at the code, why would you? Like, why should you? So just being able for the library writer to express that intent, I actually meant for this to sometimes be null. I actually didn't mean for this to sometimes be null. And then your code can be checked against that. So you use it according to intent. It's introducing another dimension of intent, if you will.
Okay. What would that even look like?
So that looks like, let's use another color now. So people can see where they're at in the video.
Yeah, nice.
Oh, they're in the red part.
Yeah.
I think we had a red part already. The second red part.
Second red part.
So that could look something like simply having public, string first name. You always have a first name.
Uh-huh.
And then you would have public string.
Maybe.
Question mark middle. Okay, so this would be annotated to, it could be null, if they didn't have a middle name, it's gonna be null. This one's supposed to not be null. And then whoever consumes that class that this is defined in, they will know that and they can relate to
it. It's almost like database constraints, but in the code.
Yeah, but types are like that generally,
yeah,
right?
That's true.
But it's an aspect, that's true. It's an aspect that databases have talked about for a long time, the not null annotations here. And here we're thinking to just reuse the question mark that's already on value types today,
yeah.
and just reusing it to state that a reference type is meant to be null. And then sort of the next, so then you could say when things are not meant to be null, how do you say that? Well, maybe we should have a bang as well that can say, is this really meant to be non-null? But then we end up with three things in the language. Then we have string, the bare old-fashioned string, and question mark, and bang. And then we're in a situation where essentially, you want to get rid of these, so all your code everywhere is going to be full of questions and bangs, and it's going to look horrible.
Yeah.
So we hope that we can get away with not having the bang and saying that, and maybe this is sort of opt-in, maybe it's even an analyzer, a Roslyn analyzer that isn't part of the language, but where you can say that now that you have a way of saying that things should be allowed to be null, maybe it's okay to say that when you don't, then things shouldn't be null. Maybe it's okay to say that not being nullable means that you're non-nullable.
Interesting, because then you could issue warnings in C# 7, and in C# 8, you could be like, there's an error.
Well, yeah, we could. We probably won't get that harsh.
Yeah.
But we want to really land on the land at a place with this feature where you only have two modalities, not three, at least most of the time.
Interesting.
So as not to like uglify all your code. Because I also think that the common thing, like the 80% case, is you don't intend for things to be nullable. So that should be the default. That should be what things just mean. It means not null. After initialization, once a constructor is run, this thing's not null. That's the most common thing, in good code at least.
Yeah.
And then this is more of a, it happens and it's fine, but it's less common. So that should be the one that has new syntax.
Interesting.
And so you change your code as little as possible to kind of express your intent.
And obviously all the stuff we've talked about is like still drawing board stuff, literally.
Well, yeah, you can see how much I'm waffling.
Well, that's okay. The thing about it is we want people to watch this and we want people to comment on what do they think.
Yeah, go here. I mean, all of this is discussed here. So we really want you to give us feedback on it. And hopefully we'll get to where, and you can kind of see us, if you go to GitHub and actually look at our code, you will see several branches where we are currently prototyping some of this. And we want to get to a spot where we can publicly share the prototypes and have people play with early versions of these features and help us understand whether these features are effective for their scenarios, which parts need to change, whether some of the features we just need to throw out, whether we misunderstood something. And that is the next level of feedback cycle, is where people can actually play with our ideas on their code and tell us what works and what doesn't.
Interesting. Have you thought of any ways to do that? I mean, it feels like you, short of like downloading the compiler and running it against some code, there's no other way to do it.
Well, but how bad is that?
It's not bad at all. I think it's great.
So right now we have some, in Visual Studio 2015, we have some technical reasons that prevent us from actually shipping a V6 and saying, here is compiler and IDE behavior. Here's an updated version of the compiler and language service. Install that V6 and
it feels like that would be dangerous to do. I mean,
that's not dangerous. That's why you want a V6 because it cleanly uninstalls and then you'd be back to your old behavior. So that's what we want to get to. We can't technically do that yet. We're hoping to change that in one of the upcoming updates so that the infrastructure is available to swap out the language service in a safe way. The compiler and language service. That's not quite there yet.
Well, it's a tough problem. You're literally swapping out the underpinnings of the entire IDE.
It's not so bad.
See, well, that's why he's the smart one.
It's mostly that we don't have the right infrastructure for it.
I see.
It turns out not to be a particularly deep problem. It's just something that needs some work. And we're hoping to get that soon because think about that. If anybody, that goes for everybody, right? All our code is open source. Everybody can do the same as we can. So if anybody could write their own, add their own language feature to C# for their own like research purposes or for fun and share it out with an IDE experience and everything, people can just plug it into Visual Studio and play with it. Imagine you're a language researcher or some, how fun that would be. So it's not just for us, it's for everyone to kind of enjoy that.
Well, that's cool.
Flexibility.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us. We learned a little bit about C# 6 and where we're thinking about going for C# 7. Please, in your comments, tell us what you think. Mm-hmm. And then also go to github.com.net/Roslyn. I'll put a link below so that you can click on it. Thanks so much for watching. I'm Seth Juarez. We'll see you next time. Take care.
Thank you.